Your neighbor's doorbell is spying on you, the tax code as economic warfare, and a new nominee for the head of the World Bank. Wait, what does the World Bank do again? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, February 5th. Kai is on assignment. Thanks for letting me join you today. We begin with the World Bank. Once President Trump gets his big speech out of the way this evening, he is expected to nominate David Malpass, Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs, to lead the organization. Malpass has been critical of the international lending body. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has a primer on the World Bank and how it might change with new leadership.
The World Bank got its start in the aftermath of World War II.
Delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference.
Those 44 delegates laid the groundwork for what would become the bank. Its initial mission? To provide loans to help Europe rebuild after the war. But that mission changed, says Erica Gould, a lecturer in international relations at Stanford.
Now it's focused mainly on development and infrastructure loans in other parts of the world, largely to low-income countries.
World Bank loans are very low interest, but come with strings attached, meeting certain environmental or labor standards, for example. But the loans also come with experts. Scheherazade Rahman teaches international finance at George Washington University.
The professional staff of the World Bank, you know, range from issues of the impact of having large dams on the environment to how tiny insects affect rice crops.
The U.S. traditionally picks the president of the bank, who has to be confirmed by its board. And, says Leonardo Martinez-Diaz of the World Resources Institute,
the president can do a lot of nudging in terms of promoting certain kinds of projects, certain kinds of expertise, and discouraging others.
Some member countries are questioning just what kind of nudging a Trump nominee might do and whether the tradition of the U.S. picking the president should continue. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One of the most contentious parts of the 2017 tax overhaul is something known as SALT. That's the provision that caps deductions on state and local taxes, including property taxes, to $10,000. It is such a big financial hit in high tax states with high property values that people are actually moving away from New York or California for lower tax states. That means lower tax revenue in New York, where Governor Andrew Cuomo said the policy was setting off, quote, an economic civil war. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Up in Verona, New Jersey, Laura Fortgang and her husband own a small business. It's a high tax part of the country. So when the government put the individual cap for their state and local taxes at $10,000,
we lose an $11,000 deduction on our taxes.
The SALT cap predominantly affects high-income taxpayers in high-tax states. New Jersey reported a 35% drop in income tax revenue for December compared to last year. And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo blames the tax cap for that state's $2.3 billion budget shortfall. How come?
More people are moving out than moving into those states.
Elda D. Ray is a partner with Ernst & Young's private client services. She says an outflow of population from states like New York and New Jersey to places like Texas and Florida was happening before tax reform, but
this will accelerate the move of individuals who have assets or earn income to move down to those lower cost, lower taxed states.
And it's not just people physically moving. Some wealthy individuals are simply changing their official residence on their tax forms to get around the SALT cap. While the new tax law cut federal income taxes for most Americans, Jonathan McCollum at the D.C. law firm Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron says the SALT cap doesn't help high-tax local governments pass tax bonds to pay for things like infrastructure.
With the elimination of the SALT deduction, people are way less inclined to support any new local or state taxes.
Some taxpayers remain hopeful, as there's still a bill in Congress that seeks to get around the SALT cap for those high-tax states. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
During the State of the Union address tonight, President Trump is expected to call for an end to the spread of HIV in the U.S. by 2030. There's a drug already on the market that could help make that a reality. It's called Truvada, otherwise known as PrEP. And when it's taken preventatively, it drastically reduces transmission of HIV. The downside? It can cost upward of $1,600 a month. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
New HIV infections are falling in New York City. Dimitri Daskalakis is Deputy Commissioner for Disease Control at the New York City Department of Health. He believes much of that is due to PrEP.
We have a lot of evidence that demonstrates that PrEP has had a significant impact, about an 18% decrease that's been caused entirely, we think, by PrEP.
That's New York, though. Experts say research is only starting to trickle in on whether PrEP is affecting HIV transmission everywhere. Truvada is an expensive pill. It can cost as much as $2,000 per month, though many people get it for less or even for free through a combination of insurance and coupons. Kenneth Friedberg is professor of medicine at Harvard. He says one reason it is so expensive?
The drug is priced really for HIV treatment.
Truvada is a mixture of drugs that are also used to treat people who already have HIV. Friedberg says in that case, it is cost-effective, and that's what's setting the price for Truvada, even though it is used as prevention.
For prevention, it's really not terribly cost-effective, again, because you have to treat a lot of people in order to prevent a single case of HIV.
The calculation changes when it's applied to high-risk groups, in which case some studies suggest it is cost-effective. The drug would be even more cost-effective if the price were lower.
It should be cheaper.
Mitchell Warren is executive director of AVAC, a global HIV prevention organization.
We know that that very same pill in its generic formulation is available for under $100 a year.
That's only outside of the U.S. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you're going to watch the State of the Union tonight, follow along with Marketplace on Twitter. Our reporters will be offering context and updates as the speech goes on. Find us at Marketplace. And tune into the Marketplace Morning Report for the global reaction on trade policy and everything else economics. On Wall Street today, everything economic is looking pretty good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're on one of those neighborhood apps like Nextdoor, you'll know that internet-connected doorbells with cameras built in are becoming very popular, especially for trying to identify suspicious characters or package thieves. Amazon has Ring, Google has the Nest Hello. But the phenomenon of doorbell video has privacy experts worried about misuse and social shaming. Laura Noreen is the director of research at Obsidian Security. I asked her how the combination of video-enabled doorbells and social media is changing the surveillance landscape.
Well, they're more widespread, so it's a little bit of combining a bigger scale, more people have them, with existing concerns about the use of video as a privacy violator and a kind of a very old-fashioned scarlet letter style calling out of things going on in the community that are upsetting to individuals. And frankly, the legal status of Ring, it puts a lot of the onus on the person who installs the camera. And I think a lot of the people who own these cameras are not aware that they're not allowed to point them at the public street or into their neighbors' yards. And I happen to be on the Ring platform myself as a user, and I can see that people are violating that particular point of the terms and service. And it leads to a lot of kind of community policing that might not be exactly fair or just.
Well, and this has really become a phenomenon, at least, you know, on my next door. There are constantly posts of photos and videos of people that were taken with security cameras and increasingly Ring doorbells. Is this a legal question or a terms of service question, the idea that you're not allowed to, that you're not technically allowed to point these cameras or doorbells at the street?
Well, so in certain jurisdictions, you can't just distribute videos of other people without obtaining their consent for copyright reasons. But for me, it's a question of, you know, combining, as I'm a sociologist by training, and so I get concerned when I see kind of micro scale policing going on. Policing is a really, you know, it's like a sociologically difficult thing to determine who's in the right and who is not in the right. And so it's a concern for me to see these big private companies kind of wandering into a terrain that has been fraught for a long period of time and almost willfully placing some of the responsibility for figuring out how this is supposed to work back onto populations that might not really understand what they're getting into.
And then what access does Ring or Amazon have to the videos that are filmed on these cameras?
Yeah, so Ring is pretty clear in its terms and conditions that people are allowing Ring employees to access videos, not live streams, but cached videos, some subset of the videos that are being uploaded just for typical usage are then being shared with their research team in the Ukraine.
And then in terms of the sort of overall legal framework for consent, you know, whether it's the terms of service, the ability to opt out, the ability to not be filmed by my neighbor when I'm on the street, it feels like our legal framework is nowhere near able to deal with this sort of like self-surveillance on a mass scale that we seem to be moving toward.
No, we really have a very version 1.0 understanding of consent procedures. As it's framed now, one company taking a fairly substantial amount of profit from a system where most of the people ending up on the app, I'm imagining, are not the owners of the cameras. So the people benefiting from the service and the people profiting from the service aren't the ones who are sacrificing their privacy. So there's a big disjuncture there. We don't have consent procedures that work at the group level. It would be very important, I think, in the future to continue thinking about how we can deal with consent at the community level.
Laura Noreen is Director of Research at Obsidian Security. Thanks so much, Laura.
Thank you.
We've been looking into some of the ramifications of Japan's aging population with our partners at the BBC. Living longer does not necessarily mean living well. In Japan, there is a bit of an old age crime wave born out of desperation and poverty. Almost 20% of the country's prison population is over the age of 60, and many of them committed crimes in order to end up in jail. The BBC's Ed Butler went to Futu Prison to investigate.
I'm standing in the recreation yard. The sound behind me is a group of new inmates. You can hear them there. They're being drilled. It's almost like a military boot camp. Several of these guys are clearly in their 60s and 70s.
In fact, altogether, some 30% of Futu's prison population is now over 60. When they're not marching, some are singing. This is the rather unorthodox start to an education session aimed at stopping seniors from re-offending. It kicks off with a group of them crooning out a song. It's all about finding life's purpose. Some seem quite moved. Afterwards, I speak to a couple of the inmates.
I first got into trouble when I retired and I lost the joy and fun of work and I looked for other things to do. If you come here several times, you get used to it.
That sentiment is surprisingly common. Close to half of all of Japan's elderly jailbirds have been convicted multiple times, and some don't even seem that bothered. Take Toshio Takata. He's 69, small, a cheerful demeanour. He seems like a cuddly teddy bear of a man, until you learn that his rap sheet includes threatening women with knives. It's one of a number of crimes, all committed in his old age, and all, he says, with a specific purpose in mind.
I reached pension age and then I ran out of money. So it occurred to me, perhaps I could live for free if I lived in jail. So I took a bicycle and rode it to the police station and told the guy there, look, I took this.
You stole a bicycle, you cycled to the police station, and you asked them to arrest you.
Yes. Another time, I went to a park and just threatened women a little with a knife. I wasn't intending to do any harm. I just tried to show the knife to them, hoping one of them would call the police. One did. As you become old in society, there is no place for you. And the care home costs so much money you can't afford it. So I think lots of people do like I do.
It is true that the crime related to poverty among elderly is going up. And this may be due to more elderly left alone.
That's Aya Abe, a professor of social policy in Tokyo. She says the weak economy has driven many younger people away from their parents' homes in search of work. It's fueled family division and a reduction in the retirement pot.
The question should be, should the poverty problem of the elderly be neglected, or should we do something about it, whether they commit a crime or not and are having a really hard time?
So you need better social care solutions for elderly people.
For the elderly poor people, definitely.
In truth, the overall numbers of elderly crooks in Japan is still fairly low, just a few thousand in a country of 120 million. But while other crimes are on the wane, old age wrongdoing is rising, and rising fast, as is the cost of incarcerating people.
That's Ed Butler from the BBC. Coming up.
Our mandate is to make everybody's day a little bit better. And so I think the best part is we change people's lives.
Making someone's day with the price of a toaster. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrials picked up 0.6% or 172 points to close at 25,411. The NASDAQ added 0.7%, that's 54 points, to end the day at 7,402. And the S&P 500 advanced 0.4%, just 12 points, finishing at 2,737. Apple's head of retail, former Burberry CEO Angela Arendt, is leaving the company. Apple stock is down about 0.2% in after-hours trading. Other retail news, a good earnings season and stocks are higher across the board. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.7%. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The Chinese electronics giant Huawei is under multiple investigations for stealing trade secrets from U.S. companies, including from a small startup that makes super strong glass using an artificial diamond coating. The FBI apparently ran a sting operation last month in Las Vegas at the CES trade show with Acon Semiconductor, the company that makes the glass. It's a trade secret thing, and also the diamond coating has potential defense applications, so it falls under international arms regulations, too. Yeah, it is a page-turner. Eric Schatzker wrote about it for Bloomberg. He was actually part of the FBI's sting operation. I asked him first about Acon.
It is a tiny company based in the Chicago suburb of Gurnee, not exactly Silicon Valley. And it's so small, it's pre-revenue, pre-customer. They're really just getting on their feet.
And in the process of getting on their feet, it sounds like they sent this invention, this sort of glass coated with a artificial diamond to make it stronger, off to Huawei. Is that right? Walk us through the story a little bit.
They're in the advanced materials business, and the founder of the company, Adam Kahn, hit on the idea that diamonds could be the next revolution in electronics. And, of course, it's the hardest known natural substance, and so it's very durable, scratch-proof, and as a result, in theory, it would be highly appealing to smartphone makers, anybody from Apple to Samsung to LG to HTC, and, of course, Huawei, which has become one of the world's largest handset manufacturers. And so he was sending samples out to these companies, and that's when he began to run into trouble.
And so this sample goes off to Huawei. What does Acon say they think happened with this sample?
Well, the sample didn't come back. That's problem number one. Huawei was supposed to return it in 60 days and was supposed to conduct only non-destructive testing. So at this point, they're already panicking. And then a few weeks more pass, and a package shows up, and they open it, and the sample is broken in two, and three shards of it are missing. And at this point, they're really alarmed because they're beginning to believe, on the basis of what they've seen and Huawei's reputation, that Huawei was up to something nefarious, was trying to reverse engineer the advanced science that goes into putting the diamond down onto the glass. And if that's the case, then they've got no business because Huawei's a multinational giant and could leapfrog them pretty quickly if they figure out the secret sauce to this diamond glass.
So then tell me about the sting. I mean, it, you know, it's sort of how that goes to an FBI sting that you as a reporter were actually involved in, right? Is a fascinating tale.
It's an unusual thing to witness a sting operation, yes. I'll say this. The sting was more or less the culmination of a months-long investigation by the FBI. So they co-opt the two principals in this company, Adam Kahn, the CEO, and Carl Sherboff, his chief operating officer, into a surveillance operation, and it begins with a conference call that the FBI monitors. And the next phase is this meeting that happens at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. And I was there. As you can imagine, these executives from this little Chicago area startup aren't exactly intelligence professionals. They've been cast adrift into the wilds of the food court at the Venetian Casino. And from there, they're supposed to conduct a professional surveillance operation, mm-hmm. which was, I have to say, from the standpoint of a reporter, pretty amazing mm-hmm. to watch.
So now, part of the reason the FBI got involved, it sounds like, is that the diamond coatings have potentially a defense application. If that were not the case, though, Huawei has been long accused of behavior like this by T-Mobile or Motorola or Cisco. But Akon, as a startup, like you said, no customers, no real resources. Were it not for this kind of defense crossover, would they have any recourse here at all?
There's every reason to believe the U.S. government is interested, may not pursue action, but is very interested in this case as one of corporate espionage. It's not unreasonable to draw the conclusion that the U.S. government has a pretty deep interest in Huawei and is looking for any number of ways to learn about the company, to document its practices, and as we saw on January the 28th, ultimately turn that into judicial action.
Eric Schatzker is a reporter for Bloomberg. Thanks for the tales of espionage.
You bet. Nice to be here.
The first episode of The Price is Right aired in 1956, and since then, tons of us have been guessing the prices of toasters, smartphones, and speedboats. During its production season, The Price is Right tapes two episodes a day. Its executive producer is the person who develops new games, works the audience, and makes sure the show makes it to TV. So we went to the soundstage to find out a bit more about that fun-sounding job as part of our series, How to Be a Blank. So Mike Richards, executive producer of The Price is Right, come on down!
My job is about putting together great shows, creating new games, making sure we have great contestants in the audience, and then ultimately making sure everything gets done on time and then ultimately on TV. You have to like game and gameplay and game theory. That's an important thing. You have to understand how things are going to work, what the probabilities of things are, because you don't want to show with all losses. I think what makes a great game show is something that has great play-along. And play-along is I'm sitting at home, and I can actually put myself in the seat of the contestant and say, I would make this decision, I would answer this question, or whatever. And I think that Price is Right has a very broad play-along, which is why it's done so well. Our mandate is to make everybody's day a little bit better. And so I think the best part is we change people's lives. I still remember we created a new game called Pay the Rent. Pay the Rent is a $100,000 game. The first person that ever won it was a woman who lives in Glendale, which is nearby. And as part of press, I got to give her the actual cashier's check and hand it to her. She has two kids. She was married. They were living in a small apartment. And she looked at me and she was crying. And she said, this changes our lives forever. Because of this, we will be able to buy a house. And a year later, it was a picture of her family standing there with the house that Price is Right in some small way helped buy. And that is what's so fun. So whether it's just winning a toaster or a car or $100,000, we've made everyone's day a little better, and that is by far the coolest thing.
That is a good job. You can take a video trip to the set of The Price is Right. Just head over to our YouTube channel. We're Marketplace APM. This final note before we go, the cold weather from the polar vortex is causing all kinds of havoc, including on electric cars. Two words, range anxiety. Electric car batteries, all batteries, actually drain a lot faster in cold weather. Also, Bloomberg reports on how those really cool doors on the Tesla Model 3, where the handles are flush against the body of the car, well, those handles are icing over and the doors are frozen shut. But a hardy Canadian Tesla owner said on Twitter that it's not a big deal. Just give the handle a good whack like the Fonz on a jukebox and it'll pop right open. Canadians know winter. All right, we got to go. A perfectly fine day on Wall Street. The Dow up 0.6%, the NASDAQ up 0.7%, and the S&P 500 advanced 0.4%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Steve Byun, Danielle Shiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the Executive Director of Digital. Sitara Nieves is our Executive Director of On Demand. And I am Molly Wood. We'll see you again tomorrow. This is APM.